interview with Captain R.C.K. Pierce, 21 of April, 1997. Captain Pierce, perhaps we can start this afternoon by you telling us when you first joined the RCN and any training or schooling that you had with the RCN or any training that you had prior to joining the service.
Well, I joined the service as a Royal Roads cadet, naval cadet, in the summer of 1944. Prior to that, I had been a sea cadet here in Victoria at the Rainbow Sea Cadet Corps. Two-year course at Royal Roads saw me graduate in 46, along with all the others of my RCN executive-type classmates. We went to the Royal Navy for training as midshipmen, and followed by sub-lieutenant's courses at the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, and at various training establishments in Portsmouth, Plymouth, and around and about England. Came back to Canada and had a career which was typical of an RCN junior officer at the time, fairly predictable promotions through the ranks of lieutenant and lieutenant commander. I saw 2 years of service out in Korea in the Sioux. Before I took over the Annapolis on commissioning, I'd been the commanding officer of the Trinity, one of our minesweepers, and following her, the Chignecto, which I commissioned in Quebec. The only carriers I ever served aboard were American carriers, and I spent 2 years on the staff of Commander Carrier Division 16, U.S. Navy, USS Valley Forge, and USS Randolph. Was promoted to commander in 1962, and having spent 2 years as a commander in Ottawa, I was appointed to the Annapolis and joined her prior to commissioning, but we commissioned her on the 18th of December, 1964. And I had the ship for 2 years before being promoted out of it and taking over as captaincy training Atlantic.
All right, thank you very much for that. If we could just go back for a few minutes. You said that you went off to the RN for midshipman training. Did you spend any time with the capital ships, RN aircraft carriers, during your midshipman's time?
I did not. I was aboard the two British battleships, HMS Howe and HMS Vanguard, which took the Royal Family to South Africa. I was one of three Canadian naval midshipmen on that cruise. There was a fourth Canadian, Jacques Vanier, son of the Governor General at the time, who was a midshipman in the Royal Navy. The sub-lieutenant, midshipman and sub-lieutenant's courses were quite a long process, starting in 1946 in my case, and finishing up in 1949. And we did all kinds of, we all had to learn to fly in those days.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was an indoctrination training in aviation, and we all qualified to private pilot license, A-level.
Oh, I see.
Single engine.
So that was your first exposure to
aviation.
First exposure
to aviation on the business end of it, anyway. We did play aircraft carrier in Korea once. We had to evacuate somebody by helicopter from the Sioux, and the only way to do that in those days was for the helicopter to land. So we had a big flat squid handling room roof on the back end of the Sioux, and we cut some of the mushroom heads off that and landed a helicopter on top of the squid magazine.
I was going to ask you about that particular incident. Now, there was two helicopters, if memory serves correctly, and they were H-5s, which in the British terminology were the Dragonfly helicopters.
It was a British helicopter, I believe, a Dragonfly.
And one accompanied there was two helicopters, but only one actually landed aboard
the
mortar well hatch aboard Sioux, if that's...
It wasn't the mortar well. It was the top of the Squid magazine.
Oh, top of the Squid magazine. Yeah. Did that... I assume that would have had to have been shored up from below in order to support the aircraft?
I think we had to support it underneath. I can't really recall. I wasn't directly involved in that. We had a couple of would-be aviators on board, Howie Clark and one or two others that had experience with carriers and aircraft.
The CEO of Sioux at that time would have been?
Paul Taylor. Commodore Taylor.
And this was in order to carry out a medical rescue, is that correct?
I believe it was. The details escaped me. It was during the Korean War, and we were up off the east coast of the west coast of Korea in the Yellow Sea.
I think that was the first instance of a helicopter landing aboard a Canadian warship other than one landing aboard HMS Puncher, the RN aircraft carrier that was loaned to the Canadians during the Second World War.
But no, I'm sure we had lots of landings on Puncher and Nabob, the two carriers, but I don't know that they were helicopters.
We had one helicopter in 1945 land aboard Puncher, one incident only as far as I can tell from the documents, but the Dragonfly landing aboard Sioux during the Korean War was the first instance of a helicopter landing aboard a destroyer, Canadian destroyer.
I expect it was, yes, because there was a certain amount of news and press coverage of that at the time. I don't have any souvenirs or clippings, but certainly that did get into the papers.
Do you remember during the Korean War Sioux ever taking part in any ASW exercises off the coast of Japan where they would have been using helicopters in that role?
I don't recall any such, no.
They were primarily used, I guess, for...
We did a lot of work in the Yellow Sea escorting British and American aircraft carriers. And... So far as I recall, the only helicopters in the carriers at that time were search and rescue type.
Or for plane guard duties?
Plane guard helicopters.
Now, if we come forward a little bit, you had mentioned that you'd spent time in two American aircraft carriers, Valley Forge and Randolph.
That's right.
What years would have that been?
This was 1958 to 1960. I was fairly new lieutenant commander at the time, having just left the Chignecto. And the admiral staff to which I was attached, Admiral Thatch, famous for the Thatch weave during World War II, a very highly decorated World War II fighter pilot. And we were part of the Hunter Killer Force Atlantic, and we had a permanently assigned group of destroyers, permanently assigned squadrons of aircraft, VP and VS, a permanently assigned helicopter squadron, HS-10, and two permanently assigned submarines, and our purpose was to go and develop tactics for the newly emerging Russian nuclear submarine fleet.
Now, would the helicopter squadron that would have been embarked, would they have been carrying out strictly plane guard duties?
No, we had a squadron of ASW helicopters.
And so those probably would have been the Sikorsky S-55, I guess, was the Canadian, or the HO-4 S-3s?
HO-4 S-3s, more like, I think. They were what I would think as the immediate predecessor of the Sea King, sonar equipped.
With the dunking sonar?
Dunking sonar capable of dropping torpedoes.
Now, the Americans, unlike the Canadians, if I read the documents correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, preferred to operate their ASW helicopters off their carriers, and they also pursued the remote-controlled helicopter, the DASH program?
They were looking into the DASH program. We never had any DASH in the Tasker. Certainly their helicopters were operated only from the carriers. There were no facilities for helicopters than any of the other vessels at all.
So prior to you taking up command of Annapolis, you were well versed in naval aviation, either fixed wing or rotary wing aircraft.
Well, I wouldn't say well versed, but certainly I had some familiarity with operating an aircraft carrier. Although I wasn't attached to the carrier, I was on the staff of the admiral, who had actually he had four carrier task groups under his command. I was at sea with them the whole time, virtually, and we lived aboard the carrier in and out of harbor. But for the actual operation of the ship, I was not directly involved. I used to keep my watch on the flag bridge in charge of the maneuvering of the fleet, wondering who would be court-martialed for what and by whom if I ran this lot into Bermuda in the middle of the night. But I didn't have any direct involvement with the operation of the aircraft. I was spent most of my time putting together plans for the next exercise phase we were doing at sea, or developing a particular idea as a possible tactic for finding and hunting nuclear submarines.
Would it be fair to say, and please once again correct me if I'm wrong, because of your experience with the American carriers and both fixed-wing and rotary-wing aircraft, when it came time to assume command of Annapolis, could be argued that you were more open-minded about embarking helicopters for the ASW role than perhaps someone else from the surface flight fleet that had no exposure to naval aviation?
Oh, I don't think I ever had any hang-ups about taking aircraft aboard a ship like the Annapolis and using it as an ASW team, you know, the ship and the helicopter. Far better together than either one or some of the parts. I guess I could say that I was comfortable with aircraft having served in the carrier, but I don't think I would have been otherwise had I not served in the carrier.
So the nuclear submarine, which the Americans were the first to launch, USS Nautilus, I believe, is the first.
Nautilus was the first, and I can't remember the dates. But let's see, 58 to 60, we were lucky enough to have a few days from time to time with the Skipjack, which was the first super streamlined submarine shape among the nuclears.
This presented a real problem for all navies.
Indeed it did, and still does, I'm sure.
This must have been particularly worrisome, I guess, for the RCN, having commissioned the Saint Laurent class destroyers, the Cadillacs, only to find that the best technology of the day was not sufficient to keep up with these nuclear submarines. Would that be a fair assessment?
I never felt it was going to be that much of a problem. I always felt that if a submarine was going to go that fast, you'd be able to hear him. And my experience with the Americans solidified this notion. And certainly when we were working with the Skipjack, and I was occasionally aboard one of the destroyers, and Skipjack would take off at 30 knots and it sounded like an express train departing. I gather the newer ones have become quieter. But
and as we know now, I guess the Russians with their boats, they were even louder than the Americans were.
I never can remember actually having listened to a Russian submarine, not knowingly at any rate. So I couldn't speak to that one. We always believed that they would be noisier than the Americans.
So you assumed command of Annapolis in 1963, is that?
64, 64. Just before Christmas, on a bitterly cold December day.
And she was building where?
She built at Halifax.
At Halifax.
Halifax Shipyards.
And how much time before her commissioning, were you actually in command of Annapolis?
Well, I wasn't in command of Annapolis until she commissioned, of course.
I thought
I stood by the ship as CO designate, mm-hmm. without a ship to command.
Right.
And, of course, the first time I went to sea in the ship, I was not in command. She was under the civilian
contractor's
command, and he had hired a civilian master mariner to take the ship to sea and do the builder's trial.
Right, and that...
I went along for the ride and to watch.
How long a process does that...
Seems to me we spent about a week, but I can't honestly remember. It's about a week, I think, we had. Oddly enough, the gentleman that had been hired by Halifax Shipyards to command the ship during trials had been the commanding officer of HMC Annapolis, the old four-stacker, during the war.
Oh, I see.
By sheer coincidence.
That is a coincidence. Mm-hmm. Following RCN acceptance of Annapolis from the shipbuilder,
yeah.
Annapolis would have gone off for her workups.
Yeah, we did.
Were there any sort of problems that you remember during the workups, seeing she had just come out of the yard?
They're the usual minor things, but no major problems that I can recall. We didn't, of course, have the helicopters with us at the time.
For the workups, right.
There was no helicopter for some time, and that was while Assiniboine was taking on the trials with the prototype bear
right.
traps. And no, we didn't have any helicopter on board. And, of course, there was no way of telling if there was any bugs in that.
Right.
I don't recall any major problems with the ship. She was always very smooth running as far as her machinery was concerned. It seems to me that everything worked pretty well. You know, there was the odd pump gland here go and minor things that would... occur in any ship that was new.
What would have been some of the major differences between Annapolis being the first purpose-built DDH in the Canadian Navy as opposed to the St. Laurent's, which had been converted in order to embark the Sea King helicopter?
I'm not sure that there was a heck of a lot of difference. I can't remember whether Assiniboine was equipped with stabilizers.
I've been told that she was, but I have seen paperwork that says that she was not. They had been investigating that, the naval constructors.
Have you interviewed Walter Blandy?
Yes, I have. I've just finished an interview with him, and he said that there were stabilizers.
Well, he probably knew then. If there were differences, they were not glaring differences to a casual observer or a non-aviator.
All right.
I had never served aboard one of the DDEs, so I can't have no basis of comparison. She was the first DDE I ever sailed in.
So what was your ship that you had commanded prior to Annapolis?
Two minesweepers.
So this would have been a substantial increase in size of warship to command.
Yeah, but, you know, I had served in the Sioux, I'd served in the Crescent, I'd served in the Huron, I'd served in the Iroquois, all in responsible positions, and so, you know, the size made little difference.
Would there be much difference in terms of handling for berthing, for example, with the big hangar?
The big hangar made it a little more vulnerable to the wind. And,
a much larger surface for the wind to capture?
Relative to the underwater surface, yeah. Not to the point to make it difficult in light winds or even fairly strong winds. I found I had to use more power and do things more quickly.
To compensate
for the rate I might get blown sideways.
When I was talking to then Commander Blandy, he said that frequently he would use tugs in order to tie up alongside if there was a strong wind.
I only used tugs once, and it was I needn't have done so. It was more an exercise for myself in the handling of the tug.
Right,
the U.S. Navy tug down in Puerto Rico. I had the tug help me back the ship down the Navy Harbor there, berth down at the far end, rather than go down and try and turn around.
I wonder if you could sort of take us through the normal sort of steps that are involved in the workups. What sort of things is the Navy doing or testing during the workup period?
Well, the workup is for the benefit of the ship's company. It's presumed that the trials you do before workups have got everything working right, the machinery and the weapons and the detection systems. And the workup itself is for the ship's company to make sure that they know how to do their drills and do their jobs and react quickly and effectively to any kind of an emergency.
Would it be inaccurate to say then that the RCN would ever accept a ship without all of these, say for example, propulsion problems being all sorted out? Is it not sort of normal that the RCN will accept a ship from the builder, and even though they've accepted the ship, there's still minor problems to work out that would be encountered and solved during the workup period?
Oh yeah, this can happen for sure. There can be conditions set that the builder will come back and put right anything that's found to be wrong. But by the time she's done builder's trials and has proven herself as a ship as opposed to a collection of weapon systems, the ship itself, which is the responsibility of the contractor, as opposed to the weapon systems, which were probably put there by subcontractors and under the supervision of technical people in the service, you can expect that the ship is going to be reasonably complete and not needing more work by the builder's yard.
So when Annapolis is conducting her workups to hone the skills of the crew, obviously Annapolis doesn't have the Sea King helicopter embarked, so what sort of workups could the crew undertake in preparation for eventually receiving the Sea King helicopter? You can't really practice aircraft handling procedures. Could you practice some drills as it relates to fueling and avgas, for example? Would that be something that you would undertake?
That can be done and was. Basic seamanship, which relates to the operation of the aircraft and anything else on board, how to fish people out of the water, and man overboard drills, fire drills, particularly fire drills with an aviation requirement. A lot of these are normally performed by the air detachment when they come aboard too, so you have to have a bit more workup when you bring a helicopter on board for the first time to make sure that the air crew are part of the ship's company and
right,
know what to do as well and how to do it. So,
When you were conducting the workups, which were down off of Bermuda, is that correct?
Seems to me we did them mainly off Bermuda and down in the warm weather.
Would Annapolis have been alone during those workups?
We were alone, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so she would have been down there for 3 months, would that?
No, about 4 weeks.
About four weeks.
Yeah.
And following the workups, did Annapolis return to Halifax?
She went back to Halifax, yeah. And I can't remember the various deployments, if you want to call them that, we had. A lot of it was just operating out of Halifax, because not long after the ship commissioned, Assiniboine went into refit and we took on, and we had the prototype bear trap for a little while.
Right.
And then we took on the first production model for further work with that.
Now, I assume that Annapolis would have had to have gone in for at least a minor refit or ANAs in order to embark the first prototype or production model of the bear trap, as opposed to...
Yeah, I don't know the technical details of that. They looked very much the same and worked in very much the same way. But undoubtedly, some changes were involved. And we also discovered that the design of the ship was not such that was proper for the whirling rotor blades and the steel mast right at the back end of the hangar. So that had to come off.
So this would have been something that came out of the Assiniboine trials, but also affected Annapolis.
Annapolis was built that way and had to be changed.
And so this would have happened prior to embarking the Sea King?
I believe so, yes.
All right, so...
I believe so.
For the chronology, Annapolis commissions late 1964. She goes through the contractor's trials for about a week.
Before commissioning.
Sorry.
Further sea trials after commissioning.
So Annapolis would have been back in Halifax in February 1965 or very early March. Would that be...
February, March 65. We wouldn't have sailed until, I can't remember when, probably mid-January. And I can't remember whether we joined up with Maple Spring exercises that year down in the Caribbean. I don't think we did. I think we were busy doing the our own sea trials and then eventually helicopter trials.
Now, Annapolis goes in for these modifications to move the mast to get that physically removed from the...
I'm not sure when that happened.
All right.
I'm not sure. You've seen pictures of the ship in its early days, I suppose.
Yes, I have.
With all this on the back. I've got a picture of her downstairs in my office with during builder's trials. We don't have a lot of the upper deck equipment on board. There are no life jackets on board, so there's great wooden boxes full of life jackets on the hangar.
Right.
On the flight deck. And sort of thing.
So when Annapolis comes back to Halifax and ties up alongside, when you just prior to embarking the Sea King and going off for more VX-10 trials,
yeah, we had the Santo Domingo thing in there, which interrupted our workup to some extent, and we went shooting off to the Caribbean to lie off Santo Domingo. We had to cancel our planned visit to Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh, I see.
And that was in the early part of 1964. So I'm not dead sure when we came back to Halifax and actually started working with the helicopter, but it might be as late as April or early May.
Right. So would the first trials with VX-10 and the helicopter have been local, seeing Annapolis had never had a chance?
Oh, they would have been in the Halifax area, yes.
So the first fly-on the helicopter probably took place in Bedford Basin, for example?
Probably. I can't really remember.
All right.
And it seems to me for the next best part of a year, we operated mainly in the Halifax area, except with perhaps it was in the spring of 65 or the fall of 64, we went to the Caribbean to participate in a fleet exercise.
That would have been a national fleet exercise.
We had the Bonaventure down there at the time. The rest of the East Coast fleet that wasn't in refit.
Would the helicopter have been embarked for that exercise, do you remember?
By golly, I don't remember, you know. It's one of the things I should.
I haven't seen any documentation on that myself.
The only occasion I can remember having the helicopter aboard for any protracted period of time was the following year, 1966. and there was a great argy-bargy between me and Ron Heath, because most of the gang in VX-10 and I and all my officers and ship's company wanted like hell to get off to Europe to be part of the NATO Standing Naval Force, which is one of the things that we did in those days. I guess we still do it, I don't know. But anyway, the three ships of my squadron were to go over there, and the Annapolis was to be the third. And we wanted very much to take our helicopter and go and be part of that major exercise, which went on for 2 or 3 months.
Right.
And Ron Heath wanted our helicopter and our platform back near Shearwater. Eventually, I won. We took her, Larry Zbytniew and MacArthur and various others, and their detachment came along, and we went over to Europe and spent a good many weeks between exercising in various European ports.
All right, we'll just stop the tape there.